Okay, well, thank you guys for coming. My name is Glenn, and I work for Odd Zero, and I'm going to talk to you about serverless. How many people have heard that term, know what it is? Serverless compute. Does anyone want to take a shot at giving me a definition?
It's a lie.
It's a lie? Okay.
It's like the cake.
People agree with that being a lie.
You don't manage.
It's a marketing term. Okay. So my name is Glenn. I work for a company called Auth0. Anybody here has heard of Auth0? Okay, so we have a solution for developers to build identity, build security into their applications, and support different types of identity providers. And we are also sponsoring this event. So before I get into my talk, I thought, it sounds like for a lot of people, just sit back and take a walk down memory lane.
New York, 1997. The entire city is a walled maximum security prison. That bridge is a mine.
Anybody here familiar with this movie?
The rulers of Patrol. And the United States Police Force has everything under control, they think.
So now you've met Snake. So Snake basically has gone to his team and he said, hey, we've got a problem. We need to basically wire up Twilio and Slack for the resistance. And what we're going to do is we need to provide a mechanism that's going to allow our soldiers out in the field to be able to send us critical messages, and we can get Slack notifications. Common need. All right, but we're going to need some servers to do this. Because what we really want to do is we've got these two different APIs. We've got Twilio, we've got Slack. We need a way to connect them. Well, the way we're going to connect them is we're going to have to put a server in the middle. It's a reasonable thing. And if we use Twilio, Twilio actually has webhooks. Webhooks are awesome. How many people here have heard of webhooks? So, you know, a webhook is just basically you have a system that can invoke a URL. Lots of systems out there today support webhooks. One of the most common ones that developers work with is GitHub. GitHub, you can basically go in and add webhooks so you can monitor activity on your repos. But there's lots of different services out there. As we've been moving more towards this cloud computing service-based world, that have adopted webhooks as a really simple model to integrate. But there's one caveat. You have to have a server. So if I go to GitHub, let's say, or I go to Twilio and I say I want to have a hook that will run whenever there are messages sent from a device, I need to stand up a server that's actually going to listen to that. Now, I might be going directly to a server that already supports that. And there are more and more servers that are coming online that actually natively understand the ability to work with webhooks. But you might need to do some kind of processing in the middle, which in this case we do. We're not just taking everything that's going to come from Twilio and send it to Slack. We want to filter and customize some of the logic. We want to pull out specific pieces of information, maybe doing transformation, etc. So, Snake doesn't like the idea of using a server. Because we need to end the server tyranny and oppression. What tyranny and oppression? What is Snake actually talking about? What he's really talking about is the pain that we have to go through deploying servers, managing servers, uptime. There's cost there to keep servers up and running, especially if they're there just for the purpose of periodic types of activity. There's scale. How do I scale these things out? Now, of course, you can build infrastructure that will scale, but that's not easy to do. And the other thing is that in this world of where we have tons of cloud services. We see browser applications, for example, that basically are driven completely by different services. And so you want to do something in the browser. If you're not working with a pre-existing service, then you have to say to yourself, okay, well, I'll just put up a server that will be there mainly to just service the needs of that browser application. So he has a plan. He says, we're getting out of server land. Where are we going? How are we going to get there? We're going to go serverless. Come on, let me hear all the applause in the room. We're going to go to Webtask. So what is Webtask? So at Auth0, we actually have this identity product, as I mentioned, and one of the challenges that we had, which is what led us to actually building Webtask, is we have a fully customizable rules engine. Now, Auth0 is a product that runs in the cloud and it runs on-prem. We actually have a service that is hosted in AWS. And one of the things that we allow you to do, one of our value props, is we are highly customizable, very developer-centric. And so when a customer who's using Auth0 allows users to log in, there's various hooks where they can write custom logic. Now that custom logic is basically untrusted code. So we have to think about how are we going to run this code up in our environment. Now one answer could be, well, we'll just use webhooks and do kind of the traditional, well, it's now becoming the traditional model. It's the prevalent webhook model, which says, hey, give us a URL, we'll put the server up and we'll run the code. Well, that raises a whole bunch of questions. Like, for example, first you have to have that endpoint deployed, which is going to handle that code. You need to make sure that that endpoint is actually going to be scalable to handle the number of requests that are coming through. There are security concerns. And one model would be, well, we just run their code directly within our application, but that has huge concerns because of security and isolation and other things. So we gradually ended up down the path of building our own serverless infrastructure. What I mean by serverless is it allows you to say, hey, I've got these business rules that I need to run at various points through Auth0's lifecycle. I don't need to deploy any kind of special server. I just give you the code, and then you take care of it for me. You make sure that that code will run, that that code has all the dependencies that it needs. I don't want to actually pay for that server to be running until it's actually needed. So what I really want is an experience of where I can give you the code, you can manage it, and I can know that I'm only going to be paying for the usage. And that is basically what the serverless model is about. When people say serverless, going through the marketing hype around it, why this term came about, is it's really about saying that, yes, there are servers, but they're not your servers. They're not your servers that you're worrying about and that you're having to manage. And you might say, well, there's things like Heroku, for example. I could run Heroku or I could run Azure websites. But even in that model, you have to think about this notion of an application. You're deploying an application and packaging up all the components of that application, and then you're deploying them, and then yes, you can get some elasticity and things like that, delayed activation. But with serverless, it's really about going even more fine-grained than that. It's saying, let's not think about this from a context of an application, because even an application becomes a monolithic thing that I have to deploy and manage. It's saying, let's go one level deeper. Let's go actually down to the level of functions. And this is where a term that you'll hear with serverless is function as a service. And that is basically the idea. The idea now is that instead of deploying lots of larger applications, I'm just deploying very fine-grained services. I can manage them individually, I can version them individually, I can upgrade them individually, I can test them individually, and I can scale them out individually. And that's a huge difference. So even if you were doing that like a Heroku site, for example, and it had multiple APIs, because you probably wouldn't do one per, you would basically group those together, well then there's a question of how does that scale up? So in a function as a service world, your scale up is functions. If this function is used more heavily than another, it's going to scale, it's going to have more utilization, and this other one that is not. So you basically have a pretty significant cost savings there. It's not all free. There are some challenges associated with it as well, like how do you manage these things? How do you version these things? So where WebTest comes in, if you go back to that diagram that I showed you, so we have Twilio, we have Slack, what's in between? WebTest will give you the ability to basically get a webhook with a server, but it's not a server that you have to manage. So you can simply say, give me a webhook, give me a URL, write some code, we'll make sure that it spins up, we handle dependency management, and I'll get into some more of the details there. So you'll also have a rich authoring experience. I will show you what that is. You can have GitHub integration, so you can actually still have your functions stored in repos, and you can have different branches and say that, oh, I want to upgrade this function, I can upgrade this function. Until I push it to the master branch, for example, it's never going to go live. It's really, really simple, and a big differentiator about our product is the fact that it works in the cloud and on-prem. So we have a hosted story in AWS. We've actually done an article on, we've done an article talking about our architecture where we talked about how we also fail over to Azure, so we can support both. But you can also run this, and many of our Auth0 customers actually run on-prem, and they run this entire infrastructure on-prem. So they're on-prem, but they're still running code that may be untrusted code. And so how do we handle this trust boundary? Under the hood, this is all containers. So we're using, this is a heavily containerized architecture, the way that this works. And that allows us to do activate things on the fly when we need to, quickly tear things down, and handle dependency type management as well. So this is what it's going to solve for you. It's going to remove a lot of the headaches around deployment, scale, management, isolation. It's inherently isolated, so everything will be isolated. We handle latency. We guarantee high availability. That's part of what our product and our service does. And as I mentioned, works in the cloud or on-prem. So why would you use it? Well, I mentioned the first use case, which is what Auth0 used it for, which was for business rules. Another big one that we've seen is just glue code. And that's an example I'm going to show you today of where, hey, I just have two services together that I need a way to wire them up. Let me do that in an ultra lightweight manner. You can make simple APIs with it. You can use it for automation. Like I've got like my build script runs. I need to fire off something. WebTask is an easy way to do that. And a lot of tools, especially modern type build tools, are supporting the webhooks model. So those are kind of the primary use cases. All right, so show us how this works, Snake. Glad you asked. So the easiest way to get going is we actually have a CLI. So if you go to webtest.io, and you guys can all follow along if you want to try this. So if you do npm install wt-cli, you'll get the WebTest CLI, and you can do this right now if you want to. The signup is super simple. I mean, you literally just do wt-init, you give it your email address, we're going to send you an activation code in that email. You click on that link, everything is active, you're ready to go. So once I've got the CLI already, and I have it here right now, so you can see I have wt, which is for WebTests. You can see here what it's telling me to do is just create a very simple function. So I'm just going to copy this. And what this is doing is it's, I could do this in a text editor. It's just dumping it out to the console. So you can see right here that what it did was it basically wrote out some JavaScript, very simple JavaScript. Module.exports is a standard way to define a module in Node.js. And it's giving me a function that's accepting a callback parameter. And then what I'm doing is I'm just calling that callback right away, and I'm outputting a message of hello. I'm not doing anything sophisticated. And it's actually given me a URL. So I can just copy this URL. And actually, if you look down here, it's telling me that it sees that I created that task. So now I can basically run it. So I can just go here and run it with the browser. And you can see I got back hello. So that's how fast it is to get going with WebTask. You just get the CLI, basically install the CLI, sign up, which is instant through the CLI, you get back that email, click that link, and then we created a task. Now notice when I called create on the WTCLI, I passed it hello.js. So I could have passed it another file, I could have made that file with a text editor, I didn't have to do it the way that I did this here. We also have a way to do bundling, so if you have multiple files, like you have files in a folder and you want to do multiple files, you can. In general, when people are building web tasks, they're doing them in a very fine-grained manner, so usually that won't happen, but sometimes it does, and we do support that ability. Okay, so that's the first thing we're going to do. Another way that you can do this, let me go back to my slides here. Oh, and also from the CLI, you can do management and other kinds of things. So if I do like WTLS, you can see that I can list the web tasks that I have. I can delete them, remove them. This is kind of things you would expect from a CLI. But another thing you can do is just get going without the CLI. And this is actually quite cool. So you can go to this URL, webtask.io/make. And what we have here, let me zoom out, is this is a cloud-based or browser-based editor for authoring with WebTask. And it's got a couple of special things in it. So I can edit any existing tasks that I have. As a matter of fact, you see here, I have a task called Hello that we just did. I can go in here and there's my task and I can edit it. You get syntax completion right there. So I can edit it, I can run it right from the editor. So if I go here and click on the runner, and I'll change this to a post, and I'll click go. And then I can see real-time logs as I go. So you can actually see that it finished the request was invoked. So we give you like an online studio, essentially, for being able to edit your tasks and create your tasks. This also works from a device. You can actually use this from an iPad or an iPhone. So that's kind of the very basics. Now the editor does a bunch of other really cool things. So it has built-in support for templates. So if I click on templates here, and here's a simple function that is returning a JSON object of I am done. So if I run this one, and I copy this link right here, so you can see that now I returned a JSON object that says I am done. I can do more sophisticated things. Like, let's say I wanted to use, let's see here, SendGrid. So we've got a bunch of different types of templates here. Templates are doing. And we're actually going to make these templates so they're customizable, so you can even add your own templates. So that's just the very bare basics of web tasks. When you're writing a web task, there are three function signatures that you can use. The default, very basic one is you just use CB, which is a callback, and you're just calling that callback, and you can pass it a response. But what we'll allow you to do is, there's some other kinds of data that WebTask is built around, which I'm going to show you in a second, that you can access off of this CTX object, which is a context object. So if you want to get access to, for example, parameters that were passed in through the query string, we hang those right off of CTX. And we also have secrets, which I'm going to get to in a minute, which is really important. But the last thing we'll allow you to do if you want to is you can just get access to the raw request and response. So if you need to manipulate headers or do anything like that, and I'm going to show you an example of where I actually need to do that, you can do that simply by using that signature. And you even can use other kinds of languages, because one of the things that WebTask has, which I'm not going to go deep into detail with, is this concept of compilers. So WebTask will allow you to write a custom compiler that supports your own language. So with WebTask, we actually have a C# compiler, and using that, then you could actually author your task in C#, which you can see in this example. But where I think compilers are really interesting is domain-specific languages. So some industries, for instance, so if you think about the business rules use case, some industries like insurance and healthcare have, you know, very specific domain terms and lots of different rules that they need. Risk analysis is another one. So the potential here is to actually be able to build compilers for specific domains that then would allow authoring of tasks using a different language than a standard programming language. You can find out more about about compilers on our website. Okay, so they're pretty impressed so far. But you can do a lot more. So if you're building, say, a Node app, the next thing you're going to need is actually modules. So we have more than 900 Node modules in the box. So let's say you want to use Twilio. Let's say the use, like an example of the use case that I have talked about earlier on is where I want to talk to Slack. We have a Slack module built in. You can just require the Slack module. It will be there, and you can write code that will talk to Slack. You can require the Twilio module if you want to use the Twilio module. And there's a ton of requests. A lot of the most common modules are out there. And we actually have our own Slack, community Slack for WebTask. And if you go there, or you file a GitHub issue and ask for a module, we'll add it right away. We actually are looking, though, in the future, in the near future, you'll be able to get access to any module that's available in NPM. Now, as a security company, we care a lot about securing your data. So one of the things that we do with WebTask is we allow you to actually define secrets. So a common use case, you're talking to some third-party service, and we've all seen the problems of where people have published like their GitHub tokens or their Azure keys or whatever it is because they included them in the repo. So with WebTask, what we allow you to do is define secrets as part of the task. Those secrets are encoded in a JSON web token, so nobody can get to them. And when you're authoring your code, we automatically surface those secrets so you can just get access to them in the code. So this way, the actual secrets themselves don't appear. And I'll show you an example of that right now. So let's say I want to add a secret called foo or something. So I can come here under secrets, and I can go and add a secret. And I'll just call it my secret value. And I'll just, you know, because I'm secretive, I'll just use $ for secret. Let's get rid of that. So now I've created this my secret value. And what I can do here is if I've used the context object on the signature, then off of the context object I have secrets. And I can go, you know, my secret value. So this is really a really, really useful feature because of the fact that when you're going to start to use WebTask, you're going to be talking to other kinds of systems, and you don't have to hard code those credentials within the code. Another interesting use case of this that we've seen, and there was an article on newstack.io, is imagine you have a website, so it's a single page application, and you want to send a message to Twilio directly. The user clicks a button, you want to send a message to Twilio. Now, Twilio has a REST API. So I could go right into my browser and just make that call. But if I do that, I'm going to have to encode my key or my token somehow in the browser so that when it makes that call, it can pass that token information along. So because WebTask is really easy to get a webhook, basically what you can do is you can go and put those secrets into a WebTask, which is secure, have the web task be the mechanism that goes and makes the call to that service that needs the secure authentication. And then what you can do is then your client actually doesn't directly see that service anymore. All your client sees is the web task. The fact that it's making a call to Twilio or SendGrid or wherever it's making the call is completely abstracted away. So one of our customers has been pretty interested in that aspect and looking at how they can use web task in that context. Okay, so let's take a look at another example. We'll use GitHub webhooks as the example. Ignore that button. So So this is the experience that I get today if I go into GitHub. I want to go and create a webhook whenever something happens. So what I could do is, on the web test editor where I have this function that I've created, I could copy this, and I could just go over to GitHub and paste it in. Okay, so now I've added that webhook. So now I could go implement it. All right, so now that I have this running, I should be able to go into my GitHub repo and make a modification, and I should see that that will fire. So I'll go here, and I'll just make an arbitrary modification. Okay, so we can see that that webhook fired, and I can see it in the editor. So that's a pretty simple use case, but a very common one that, you know, like, think about it. Think about all the times that you want to basically monitor your GitHub repos. Now that becomes very, very simple. And on that note, we actually support GitHub integration with WebTask as well. So if I'm authoring my tasks and I want to, I can basically wire up to a specific repository or create a new repository. So now I can take advantage of branches and things like that as part of my authoring experience. So I can say, well, I've got a dev branch, I've got a master branch. The master branch is the branch that basically is going to push the web task live. And this way I can support different types of environments. And if I wanted to, I could actually have two versions of the same task bound to different branches. So if I wanted to say, well, here's a test version of the task, and this is the live version of the task, you can do those kind of things as well. All right, so let's now dive into a more sophisticated example, now that you've seen kind of the basics. And this was what we mentioned earlier. So we're going to have Twilio, and what we're going to allow is we're going to let people be able to send text messages to a specific account. And then based on those messages, something's going to happen. So there may be messages that are sent to Slack, and I also pulled in Splunk so I can basically monitor all the activity that is happening. And just to illustrate the use case here, I'm providing that glue between these different services. So first, let me show you the task, and then we will... Well, we'll start this way, and then I'll take a look at the code. So what I want you guys to do is go and SMS to this number. And there's two kinds of messages you can send. So you can send any message, in which case you're just basically letting us know that you're okay. You're letting us know your status. And if there's a problem, send 911. And what you're going to notice when you send 911 is, depending on what you send, the response should be actually different. Did you guys get back a response? Slack the room. Okay, so somebody sent help 911. Now, if you're not sending 911, all that information should be showing up within my Splunk instance. So I'm just going to open that up. So for those of you who are not aware of Splunk, Splunk is a tool for mining, basically for aggregating different types of log data, and you can mine that data, machine data. So I've got my web task configured to be sending that information as well as each request comes in to Splunk. So if I change this to be a 30-second real-time query, you can see, for example, that that message just came in, and that has all of the Twilio information. So part of the reason why I want to be able to manipulate things is because to Splunk, I want to send everything. To Slack, I only want to send a subset of the messages, and I'm pulling out the pieces that I'm interested in. So you can see, here you go. Okay, so we see the end to end. So how did this work? So if I come into my web task editor, I can actually edit other tasks. You can also do this from the CLI. Let's hide the logs. Can you guys see that text, or do you need me to make it bigger? I'll make it a little bigger. So first, we're going to use secrets here. And the reason we're going to use secrets here is because of the fact that in order to talk to Splunk, I need to have an authentication token. I have a URL where that Splunk instance is running, which is running in the cloud. And also to talk to Slack, there's the Slack URL, which is really like a secure secret, because that's going to allow you to be able to send data to that Slack channel. So this is where the secrets feature is quite nice, because you can see that I just configured that right into the UI here. Now let's take a look at the code. So as I mentioned, we have support for like 900 different Node modules. So it turns out that Bunyan is a pretty popular logger in the Node world. And for Splunk, we have there's an integration that will allow you to use Splunk with Bunyan. So I'm requiring the Splunk Bunyan logger, and then I'm requiring Bunyan. So now here is my code for my web task. Now because I'm working with Twilio, I need to actually have direct access to the response because it's XML, yes. And I need to be able to override the media type to say that it's XML and to be able to return that XML payload. I don't want it to just go back as JSON. So I'm using the signature that allows me to get access to the context, the request, and the response. You guys following me so far? Is you can think of these containers as a warm set of containers. We have a warm set of containers that don't actually have the actual code on them yet when you first grab them. So when a request comes in, what we basically do is we know whether or not we actually have a warm container that's available. We know if we already have a running container for that specific task. If we do, the request will get routed to that specific container. If we don't, we will basically grab one from the warm pool. And the latency cost is really low because of the fact that the container itself is actually already running. So that's a big difference between how we have decided to approach this problem, is that an alternative way to approach this problem is the container is not running, and then it runs on demand at the time when the request happens. But in that model, you can pay a significant amount of latency on the startup, which for backend use cases probably doesn't matter because some data came in and the first time it took a little bit longer to get it to the final place. But because of the fact that we're talking about, like, say, login, you're logging into a system, users care a lot about login. If that login is slow, then it's going to slow down the whole system. So this is why we've optimized around this model. As far as we are highly available, so we have a load balancer, we can grow the cluster. We have clusters all around the world, so yeah. Did you have a specific question you wanted to know?
As the request volume increases, do you increase the number of containers that...
We monitor, so we are constantly monitoring, 24/7, so we're constantly monitoring things. We haven't ran into any load issues yet, but we certainly watch it. And we have had cases where, because of a problem that happened, that we went and added like an additional cluster, so to handle more of a failover thing. But we do, we definitely monitor, and we're elastic in terms of our architecture, so we can easily either grow the instances, so we can support more containers on those instances, or we can add more clusters. And just to be clear, this is not new. This has been running for 2 years in production. It runs on zero. So we built this first to kind of support our needs, which is why I had that slide about scratching our own itch. And then we realized, talking with a lot of our customers, that there was a lot of interest in using this as a standalone. And then with the rise of all the serverless, we realized that the industry thinks this is a pretty interesting idea. So. That was why we went down that path. Cool. Any other questions? Yeah?
If a web task fails, how does it require you to debug?
First off, so
It's an HTTP. Which kind of failure? It depends on which kind of failure. I mean, at the end of the day,
this is
a
backend task and I'm using it as a fire and forget.
So if you're using it as a fire and forget model, inherently the way web tests, so we do have a logging endpoint. So we have a logging endpoint, a streaming logging endpoint that you can monitor if you want to pick up logs real time to see when there's problems. We don't today have like a persistent logging solution. So you can tap into our stream and listen to it, and we have customers that are doing that, or you can use our CLI. As far as notifying the client back, I mean, the whole idea of doing fire and forget is it's fire and forget from the client perspective. It is a web server that's running, so if it's like an application error, and as long as you haven't immediately returned a response to say that you want to go on and continue doing processing, then the client will absolutely get that response. So if there was some type of validation or something running in the code, the client's going to get that back as part of the HTTP response. So you have full control of the HTTP response to craft it. Does that make sense? Anyone else? So one of the things we also allow you to do is we have some state. It's a minimal state, but we actually have off of the context object, there's also a data object. And if you want to keep track of some type of state for your particular web task, as long as it is within a small size, I think it's like 500K is what we allow you to store for the document, you can actually have a JSON document, and similar to the secrets, we'll make sure that that document is available. You generally want to be careful how you use it because of the fact that in a high concurrency type of situation, you could get into situations where, for example, we have some concurrency support where you can say, oh, since I last got this document, it changed, so you can write that kind of code. But that capability is there. I wanted to mention a little bit about the compilers too. So I talked about how you can change the programming model essentially. So what we allow you to do is you can register a compiler, and that compiler is basically a function. And then what that function does is gives back another function. So it gives you that ability to parse and to then return another function, which will be the final function that will get executed. And this was the way I gave you the example of where we use this for using Edge for C#. And we've got a whole bunch of examples of compilers that you can go to. So one example is we've had customers that said, well, I want to actually have multiple routes within my web task. I want to have routes to like foo and bar. Now I can parse the raw request, but one of the reasons why we build compilers is we actually have the ability to use Express right within that web task. So it's still a web task, but this way if you want to have multiple routes within that web task, you can actually do it. So you can see here where when I'm within my node code, I'm newing up and I'm requiring Express, and then I'm defining a get route. I can define a get route, post route, et cetera. So that's kind of interesting because you're still using this in a fine-grained fashion, but then if you want to have some more fidelity and control over HTTP, you could do it. Like if you said that my function operates differently when it's a get versus when it's, say, a put or a post. So that's not all. Now, does anybody know where that picture is from? That's from Escape from London, correct.
Of course.
So we want to make the web tasks, the web hooks flow even easier. And so this is an idea that we've been exploring that I want to show you. This is a preview. This is not something that is live yet. So I'm going to close all of these. And I'm going to go back to GitHub like I did before. Yeah. Okay. So now I need to create my webhook. So imagine a flow like this. where I click create web task right within GitHub, it creates for me the webhook because it's created for me a web task, and then right from there I can go edit it. So I don't have to, like, you know, run the CLI, I don't have to go to the site first. And so we're kind of imagining, like, this is a pattern that could work for lots of different systems where, say, hey, you want to create a webhook, you have a seamless flow right from, you don't have to do a context switch, right from that particular location, you can create that webhook. So that's kind of, that's just the beginning of the ideas that we're thinking about, but we want to really go further in making this webhook experience much simpler. So we are done. So now what you have to do is tell your friends about it, relieve them of their server pains, bring them to use WebTask. Thank you guys very, very much. If you want to find out more about WebTask, you can go to webtask.io, and I'll hang around if there's any questions.